It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
With sexual harassment allegations against film mogul Harvey Weinstein, it seems more and more prominent figures have found themselves facing allegations of their own. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Seems not too long ago that Roger Ailes, founder of Fox News, was hit with allegations of sexual harassment. He was forced out of the network. That was quickly followed by charges against Bill O'Reilly, who was also forced out. Events began to escalate and them appeared to break. Suddenly, many in the media found their alleged misdeeds coming back to haunt them. It even hit National Public Radio with the departure of the head of the news division. But while these are high-profile cases, sexual harassment, especially in the workplace, is not confined to big jobs or the media. A recent survey of 2,200 part-time and full-time female employees between the ages of 18 and 34 found that one in three said they had been sexually harassed at work, and 81% said they had been verbally sexually harassed. We turn first to Dee Copeland with the Life Crisis Center on the Eastern Shore. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Well, first of all, I want to get your own reaction to these very big, high-profile cases. We obviously have Harvey Weinstein. Before that, I mentioned we had Roger Ailes, and of course, during the presidential campaign, we had Donald Trump and his remarks about what was clearly harassment, of sexual harassment of women. What do you make of this new focus? It's almost as if every day we hear something new.
Right. Unfortunately, it's not anything new. What has happened is these high-profile cases, because they're high-profile, now we're hearing about it more. And sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual misconduct happens more than we would like to think. And it seems to get the most attention when it is someone high profile.
Are you surprised at that it's broken at this particular moment? And like, why not before? I mean, do you ask yourself that question?
Well,
because it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, sexual harassment, assault, misconduct has been around for a very long time. And one of the things that it's different, there are some people, some women, some organizations now are more willing to have these open conversations and open dialogue. And sometimes there's this effect of when one person shares, it empowers the next person to feel like they can share and they realize that they're not alone. Because usually sexual harassment, sexual assault usually happens in the confines of the victim and the perpetrator, and it happens in silence. And so when someone breaks that silence, it almost gives the next person permission to say, I am not alone. This has happened to someone else. I'm not crazy. That wasn't right what happened to me. And so for some women or men, they then feel empowered to come behind and to further disclose what has happened to them. So no, I'm not surprised.
Do you think that we're seeing a major shift, or do you think we're going to pay attention to this for a while and then it's going to disappear, or has it emboldened people, even if the media doesn't say focus in on it, that there's something else now that's gotten away, we're not going to go back?
I would like to think that we're moving in the direction that more people are willing to come forward or more people are open to have a dialogue about sexual assault, sexual harassment, and what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. But I also do know that sexual assault, I know we're talking about harassment, but yeah, when we're looking at sexual assault, it's one of the most unreported crimes that we have. So while I have hope, I still think we have a long road ahead of us. And I think it does help that we're willing to have these open conversations and dialogues.
In the survey, by the way, I mentioned a moment ago, in it, and I didn't find a stat for it, but there were a number of women who didn't necessarily realize that they had experienced sexual harassment. I guess one of the questions becomes, what is that definition? And two, why is it that some women may wonder whether or not, or not even realize that something has happened?
Well, when we look at sexual I'm going to use a broad term now. When we look at sexual trauma, sexual assault, it happens on a continuum. And so on a continuum, we have touching behaviors or non-touching behaviors up to touching behaviors and everything in between. So sexual harassment falls on that continuum where it's unwanted either sexual contact or sexual gestures or innuendos, jokes, and it makes, and it comes from a person that's in a position, when we're talking about the workplace, it can come from a position of a person that's in authority that then uses their authority to gain these sexual favors, so to say. Or it could even be a peer-to-peer. Again, it's in a workplace. So maybe that person's not my supervisor, we're peers, and it creates a hostile work environment in the sense where I don't feel comfortable or I feel on edge, but I feel like I can't say anything because it is my job, it is my workplace. And everyone has a right to go to a workplace to feel safe physically and emotionally and to feel like that they're not going to be ostracized because they don't participate in a joke or in a certain touching or non-touching behavior.
How much does repetition play into this? I mean, I remember when Anita Hill, as a matter of fact, came out talked about now Justice Thomas. And one of the things that struck me was it wasn't just a single incident, but there were a series of incidents that when you started adding it up, mm-hmm. you began to get a much fuller picture. How much is repetition an issue as opposed to, say, a single incident?
First, depending on what that single incident is, some people might take that single incident and dismiss it and say, okay, well, maybe I'm being a little too sensitive. Maybe it's not what I thought it was, because many times we tend to like to think the best of people. And so when something happens that gives us pause, we sometimes say, well, maybe I'm overreacting. And so they might dismiss that one incident. Or maybe they're newly hired and they don't want to make any waves. Or they feel like if they say something, they won't be supported or believed. So it depends on what that single incident is. But sometimes that single incident is what the person thinks it is, and they still dismiss it, but then it happens again, and then it happens again. And then before you know it, sometimes the individuals feel like, well, I can't come forward now because it's been happening for a while. Or maybe some people don't define it as sexual harassment, and so it continues, and they feel like, oh, this is just par for the course. Oh, this is just maybe how it goes, or this is just locker room conversation, or oh, this is just what men do, and I just have to deal with it, and I have to put up with it.
Do you find that to be prevalent in many ways for women to think that, well, it's just something that I have to put up with? I mean, I've talked to a number of women, and they've said, you know, that's just part of doing business. We just have to deal with it, which sounds to me like really not acceptable, but they seem to just sort of come to terms with this idea that this is the way the world is.
Unfortunately, there are some that feel that way, especially if the woman is in a male-dominated type of profession or business. And so she may feel like, well, this is just what they do. You know, I can handle it. I can deal with it. And maybe on some instances, the person can. But they're still... they have a right to be in a work environment that is free from any type of harassing behavior, whether it's physically harassing or with words and gestures. But many do say, I can handle it, and this is just part of the work environment, and I can deal with it.
Survey I mentioned a moment ago said that of the women who experienced workplace sexual harassment, 29% reported the incident, 71% did not. What is that a failure of? Is that a failure of the system? Is it a failure of women to, say, report it in a sense of fearfulness? I mean, is it just we don't have those things in place?
I think it's all of the things that you just said, because that statistic ties very closely when we talk about rape and why women don't report, and the number of people that report versus the ones that don't report. Very close statistics. And so it could be that they're in fear of losing their job. Especially if their job, you know, that's how they support themselves. That's how you pay the mortgage. That's how you pay the rent. That's how you pay the car note. That's how you take care of your children and your family. And so if they feel like if I come forward, all that might be jeopardized. Or maybe the work environment, maybe there's a culture where things like this are accepted and they feel like, well, who am I going to go to? Especially if it is a supervisor or if it is coming from someone that has a position of influence, they may feel like I don't have anyone to go to. Or the other piece is they may feel embarrassed or ashamed of what's happening, and they are fearful. Maybe they have been threatened. Maybe there is some intimidation going on. So it really depends on the situation. And for some, they might not define it as sexual harassment or sexual misconduct. And so they haven't defined it as such. And so they don't report it because they haven't defined it themselves.
Do you think that part of that reluctance, by the way, is that, you know, we're concentrating on the fact that all this stuff is taking place in the workplace, but there's a continuum. I mean, mm-hmm. when you grow up, I mean, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of incidents in your life, even before you even get to the workplace.
Exactly.
Do you think the fact that those experiences acclimatize yourself to the idea that, okay, there's this behavior, and then when you go into the workplace, the structure is different, but it's a continuum behavior?
That's a very good point, because we all have our roles that we play in our families, in relationships, and when we go into our work environment, we bring, you know, a part of how we were raised. We bring our past experiences, good, bad, and everything in between. And so depending on how I grew up and how males and females were looked at, what roles women played in the family, what roles men played, if there's any previous sexual trauma, for example, that could impact how a person responds to anything currently that's going on in the workplace, how women's position in society is defined within the family. So many of those things do contribute to what a person brings to the work environment and what they may speak on about or what they may be silent about. There's just so many factors that play into why a person may say something or may remain silent.
How significant is it to have, say, women, other women in positions of power and positions that are responsible? And is there a threshold issue? That is to say, if you have one woman who might be in power, well, that's great. But if there's like 11 other guys sitting on the board, you may go to that woman, but she's got her own issues. And she's got her own position to protect.
And I guess that's a tricky question, because when we talk about harassment, we usually talk about women being the victims, men being the perpetrators. But what we do know is that the opposite can happen. Hmm. Also, women can be perpetrators as well, and men can be victims. And not all women think alike. Right. And so not all women support other survivors and victims and what they're going through. I mean, I've been doing this work for 15 years, and some of the worst comments to survivors come from other women.
What do they say?
Well, you know, well, what did you think was going to happen? Well, why were you wearing that short skirt? Or why did you invite him up to your apartment? Didn't you know what? He could have anybody. Why would he have to rape you? So sometimes we can't assume that women are always going to be supportive of other women or of other survivors.
Now, one of the things, by the way, I mentioned a moment ago with the opening that we obviously have been concentrating on big names, big jobs. Mm-hmm. But in the survey mentioned a moment ago, something like when we look at industries in terms of where sexual harassment takes place, something like 42% in the food service, hospitality, very low, you know, mm-hmm. pay. Retails, 35%. The legal profession, 30%. So we obviously are focusing on those big jobs and high-profile figures, mm-hmm. but particularly at the lower end of the economic scale, this seems to be a real serious problem.
And right. And so it is not confined to just one particular type of job, you know, low profile, high profile, in the middle, menial jobs, because sexual harassment, sexual trauma is a humanities issue. And we take who we are in all of these different venues. And so because of that, there is potential for these things to happen no matter where you go, no matter what your background is, no matter what your race is, religion, culture. It doesn't matter, because it's a humanity issue.
Finally, are you ever surprised at, I guess it's the grossness of some of the behavior that you see on the part of perpetrators? I mean, I must admit, particularly reading some of the stuff that's been going on about the big media types and so on, the actors and so on. Mm-hmm. My reaction is, what are you thinking? I mean, that's not something you would do no matter where you are.
Right. Well, I think in 15 years I've been doing this work.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not much surprises me anymore, because in this job we see the worst of people and you know, what victims have endured at the hands of offenders and perpetrators. And so I'm not surprised, because I think we have to remember, at the root of sexual trauma, sexual assault, sexual harassment is also power and control. And so people are using sex or sexual acts as the venue or the avenue to exert that power and control. And so, unfortunately, I am not surprised at what humanity, what humans are capable of doing.
We've been speaking with Dee Copeland. She's with the Life Crisis Center here on the Eastern Shore. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us about this, and hopefully we'll see some progress in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We now want to turn to Mike Farlow. He's an attorney who specializes in sexual harassment cases on the Eastern Shore. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me also get your reaction to what seems to be a flood now of big names. Started, seems, a long time ago with Roger Ailes. And, of course, had Donald Trump during the campaign. But now the floodgates seem to be really wide open with Harvey Weinstein. What's your reaction? Why do you think we're seeing that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to remember that this goes back a long, long time. You start with Roger Ailes, but, I mean, think back, Bill Cosby, Anita Hill with the Clarence Thomas hearings. Sexual harassment has been an issue that's been with us for a long, long time. And there's been a gradual buildup of people who have been willing to ultimately reveal what's been happening. And we have to remember that the victims here have gone through some of the deepest, darkest times of their lives as a result of the people who have been harassing them. And when we get to Harvey Weinstein, and I don't think that we can view that in a vacuum, when we get to Harvey Weinstein and so many women come out saying, he did this to me, he did this to me, he did this to me. And these were women who thought that they were isolated, who thought that they were alone. And all of a sudden, there are so many other people who are saying, yes, this happened to me. It reinforced the message that they were afraid to say before, which was, this guy is a serial predator. He was attacking us, and somebody needs to listen. And if you looked at social media right after people started talking about Harvey Weinstein, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you started seeing the hashtag MeToo. And after you started seeing the hashtag MeToo of women that never told anybody that they had been harassed or abused, all of a sudden we start getting reports of other people. Other producers, other actors, Kevin Spacey, people have been talking about him, an NPR right. News director just this week. A couple of women came forward saying that he had harassed them when he worked for another news agency. And that reinforcement is what's finally letting people feel comfortable in their own skin coming forward with something that is really very private and has been very traumatic to them.
Do you think, by the way, talking about social media, do you think that's been a factor in accelerating this place? That is, that suddenly you can see a lot of other people who have been impacted, whereas, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, you might have felt isolated because you couldn't connect.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, 20 or 30 years ago when, again, the Anita Hill, when she came forward about Clarence Thomas, people would say, this man was a very high-profile lawyer. He was a judge. He's now nominated for the Supreme Court. How could he possibly do something like this? And Anita Hill was essentially vilified by the public and the press and the people in the congressional hearings for coming forward and telling a very deeply personal story. And today, because people are able to share their experiences and share it with all of their friends and see other people sharing that experience so they don't have to feel alone, it has really empowered people to be able to say, look, this is a serious problem. It doesn't just happen to people that you see on TV. It doesn't just happen in Hollywood. It happens right down the street. It happens in our schools. It happens in the places that we work. It happens all over. And you have to realize that the people in your life that you love may have been carrying this secret for a long, long time and haven't told anybody.
Well, speaking of Anita Hill, because it's something that we touched on earlier in the program, because I remember Anita Hill when she came out with her allegations, that there were a number of women who testified against her, who suggested that either these things didn't happen or there was some ulterior motive. Rather than being sympathetic, what do you make of that dimension of our society.
Well, your last guest mentioned it, that sometimes some of the most critical people of the victims are other women. I've seen it myself in court on many occasions. I used to be a prosecutor, and a lot of times defense attorneys would pick women for sexual assault trials, especially older women, because they felt that they would be more critical of the victims. And that's a shame. You know, when people don't just typically go around saying, hey, something really traumatic happened to me for no reason. Usually when they say that, something did happen.
So when someone comes into your office, says she thinks she's been sexually harassed, what do you tell her? What's the process that you go through? And is empathy for this person a key factor in how you approach them?
Well, you have to be empathetic to anyone who has gone through a trauma like this. People don't like to come forward and talk about these things because they are deeply personal. Sometimes the incident of harassment might be minor, but a lot of times it's a continuing course of action. It's something that has gone on over a period of weeks or months, and it's gotten to the level that they simply can't tolerate it anymore. And when somebody gets to that level, when they get to the level where they're coming to a lawyer, they have really reached the edge of their ropes. And so you have to listen to the person, let them tell their story, and then you have to tell them that sometimes these aren't the easiest cases to prove, and there's a process that's not exactly victim-friendly that they have to go through, because they need to be aware of what's going to happen and what they have to do to be able to meet even the bare minimum for the courts to look at it. You know, they have to file a complaint with the EEOC. They have to go through a process where their complaint is evaluated, where the EEOC looks at it and says, yes, there's something here, or no, there isn't, before they, in many cases, before they can even get to court.
When you lay that out for somebody, obviously it depends on the specific circumstances and whatever evidence there might be, but when you lay that out for them, what kind of reaction do you get? Because that must seem daunting once you start. You go into an office, you certainly lay bare your own personal experience, and then you get sort of the blind, I don't know what the blind side is quite the word, but this, okay, well, we can go forward, but there's this big hill to climb.
Every person's different. Some people are at the point where they're completely resolute. A lot of people say maybe it's not worth it at this point. It just depends on the person. And that's why it's so important to lay it out ahead of time so that they know what they're facing, so that they know that just reporting it isn't always enough. But that's what's so gratifying about seeing the people who have come out against these producers and actors and news people over in Hollywood and New York is that they haven't had to go through that process. They've just had to reveal what's happened, and the market is taking care of issues. You know, Harvey Weinstein got fired by his own company shortly after people started going public with this. Now, it's not like people didn't know Harvey Weinstein was doing it for years and years. There's episodes of 30 Rock where they talked about how, you know, it was a running joke with comedians. But when people came out and put a name and a face to the person that he was harassing, it made it instantly available to everybody to see that this is somebody who was really doing that. It's not just the butt of some joke. This was really happening. He's a creep and he needs to go. And he was fired. And we've been seeing that over and over again in the past few weeks, that people who have been not just accused, but the stories of the accusers are so specific and they're supported by other accusers that they're facing what should have happened to them probably a long time ago.
No, we've obviously been talking about big names, but, you know, if you're somebody who's working for a company, how much support does one get from, say, fellow employees? What kind of reaction are there from fellow employees, both men and women? What kind of sense, is there any support there? Unlike, for instance, what we're seeing with, you have a high-profile name and you come out, And now, and it's whether it's against Spacey or Weinstein, and say, "Hey, what's going? This is what's going on." And suddenly, there's all these other people who come in that they support. Does that take place inside of a company?
Well, again, every situation is specific, and it's really difficult depending on some of the companies. You know, if it's a very small company, and one of, say, a handful of employees is saying, "Hey, look, I'm being harassed," they might face a lot of resistance from the other employees simply because, you know, if the boss is the one doing the harassment, that's the goose that laid the golden egg. Mm-hmm. What are you doing endangering our jobs with this complaint? Other times, even in small environments, people can be very accepting. Maybe that happened to me. Maybe that I saw that happen to somebody else. Sometimes a lot of what you get in companies is the subtle warnings. You know, at the Christmas party, stay away from so-and-so after he's had a couple of eggnogs. He might get a little handsy. And those are the sorts of things that you see in companies.
Why do you think it is that these kinds of activities may go on that everybody seems to be aware of or heard rumors about, and yet people act as if they're not happening except to stay away from this person at Christmas party?
Well, you know, a lot of times it's that factor of nobody has specifically said what happened. You hear the rumors. It's just gossip. Maybe it's fodder for the rumor mill. But until somebody really says, "Hey, X, Y, and Z happened. He did this to me. And something needs to be done." In many cases, people don't do things about it. I mean, look at Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby raped dozens of women. There's no question about that. And lots of people in Hollywood knew about this. It was something that had been reported over and over again. But nobody really put all the pieces together until a comedian makes it a part of his bit. And as soon as that bit becomes viral on the internet, all of a sudden, the women that Bill Cosby had raped started coming forward one after another after another. And sometimes that's what it takes is the specific issue to become public so that people can be aware of it. And when I say public, I'm not necessarily meaning public to the entire world. If it's in a business, public to the people in that business.
So if someone thinks that they're being experiencing harassment, because I indicated earlier in the program, some women don't realize this might be the case. How are they supposed to, A, determine whether or not they're actually experiencing harassment, as opposed to some flirtation, whatever might be acceptable in some venues? And what do they need to do about it? How do they assess their situation before they even say come to you?
Okay. From a legal standpoint, there's two types of harassment. There's what's called a quid pro quo harassment, which is what we've seen a lot of over in Hollywood. That's the Harvey Weinsteins of the world saying, "If you have sex with me, then I'll make certain that you get a part in my next movie."
Pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward. Or if you don't have sex with me, you'll never work in this town again. Pretty straightforward. And that's almost always somebody who is in a position of power, who's trying to assert their dominance over people. It may not even be truly sexual from their perspective. It may just be an issue of exerting power. And then there's the hostile work environment, which can be from a boss to a subordinate, but it can also be peer-to-peer. And that's the kind that is much less obvious, much more difficult to assess whether the harassment is actually there or not. And it's important to remember that the harassment, whether there's harassment or not, is from the perspective of the person who's being harassed. The person who is telling dirty jokes in the office might just think that they're being funny. But to somebody else who maybe has had some prior traumatic experience, those dirty jokes aren't funny. They're very painful reminders of something that may have happened to them. And in those sorts of situations, the person who's being harassed should, first of all, never feel bad or ashamed about coming forward to anybody. Any business that's worth its salt has some sort of sexual harassment policy that lays out who they should report to, what they should do in a situation in which they feel like they aren't being heard or that somebody is harassing them or that they're in a hostile situation. And then the higher-ups can evaluate and see what's going on, because sometimes it may very well be a miscommunication between people, and it can be addressed very quickly and easily by saying to one person, look, you think that you're funny, but you really aren't. You need to stop it, and if you don't stop it, then we're going to take further action. But sometimes the incidents might be of a much graver sort, and it could be the Clarence Thomas example of placing his pubic hairs on top of a soda can and giving it to Anita Hill, something that's really beyond the pale, that is just overtly gross. And she didn't have any avenue at the time of being able to report that. And those sorts of things, if they're reported, they should be investigated by the employer. If the employer is the one doing the harassment, most sexual harassment policies have somebody else that you can report to so that it can be investigated, so that remedial measures can be taken.
How responsive are employers and that you found as you move forward?
I've found that employers are very responsive. Most employers want to make certain that their employees are happy. If an employee is unhappy, they're not going to be productive. They're not going to do a good job. It's going to affect the bottom line of the business. And that's before any lawsuits. I mean, obviously, no business wants to be the subject of a sexual harassment lawsuit, but it's a lot more basic than that. The employers want their employees to be happy. They don't want nonsense going on in their offices. They certainly don't want overt sexual harassment going on. They don't want minor sexual harassment going on. They want everybody to be a good employee and almost like a family.
What's the success rate of these lawsuits?
Well, by the time it gets to the point where it's a lawsuit, they're usually fairly successful because they go, as I said before, they go through a process where they're evaluated by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which then gives a determination as to whether or not harassment exists and whether they can go forward with lawsuits. And so at that point in time, you've really got basically the government behind your back saying that it happened. But before that, it may not always be successful. And a lot of times these things never even get to the EEOC. They never get to court because they're addressed either beforehand by the employer or, unfortunately, the person has just decided that the process isn't worth it and so they're going to find other employment.
Finally, briefly, do you think there has been a shift in the way we view this problem, and that because of particularly the high profile, that aside from us, you know, moving on to other subjects as this thing unfolds, that something underneath is going on, that maybe women are going to be more forthcoming, that people are becoming more aware? Is there a social dynamic change that's happening here, you think?
I certainly hope so, and I really think that there is, because, again, in the past month, we've seen so many people who have come forward, who've been emboldened by other people who have shared their stories. And so now more and more people believe that it's acceptable to share the stories that they have, and they don't feel that they're alone. And that's the most important thing. They don't feel that they're alone, and so they're able to tell what happened to them.
We've been speaking with Mike Fotto. He's an attorney on the Eastern Shore, specializes in sexual harassment cases. Appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour together each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting. And we can share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality.
Saturday mornings at 7 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask, why? I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
The first indictments have come down on the Mueller investigation. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and the campaign official Rick Gates have been indicted in the Russia investigation. Special counsel Robert Mueller has charged them with conspiracy against the United States, conspiracy to launder money, among other offenses. Meanwhile, George Papadopoulos, who was involved with the foreign policy side of the campaign, has pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russians. The administration has emphasized that much of the Manafort and Gates charges involve conduct predating the campaign. Meanwhile, Papadopoulos' plea has led to the withdrawal of Sam Clovis, who supervised him on the campaign, from a post in the U.S. Agriculture Department. Sort out these latest developments in our studio. Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what do you make of these indictments? Some suggest that this is the first shoe to drop, that there are more to come. And they are almost sort of bookends, because on the one hand, you've got Manafort and Gates, particularly Manafort, big high-profile name. On the other hand, nobody's ever heard of George Papadopoulos, who's like on the lower part of the food chain. Where do you assess where we are?
Well, I think the analysis that's persuasive here is that this indicates that the Mueller investigation is going forward quite rapidly, much more rapidly than, for example, was the case under the Watergate situation. But it is essentially identifying a big fish with Manafort and a tiny fish with Papadopoulos. But the Papadopoulos case is the conversations. I mean, here's a guy who clearly wishes to tell the story and wishes to essentially explain who he talked with, what he said, and is really setting up a case where this investigation is just really beginning in this respect. That those who say that, well, this is the end point, I think it's wishful thinking really coming from the White House.
So one of the key moments, I think, in terms of this story has got to be a March 2016 meeting in which we have Papadopoulos, we have Jeff Sessions, and we also have Donald Trump. And apparently Papadopoulos merges with this idea about setting up some kind of meeting between Trump and Putin, and obviously then revealing his connections or his contacts with the Russians. It seems to me that that really kind of begins to reach beyond just simply the outer layers, which we maybe have occasional contacts, meetings, right up to Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is clearly present during these conversations.
Absolutely. And here, this really, I think that the picture in itself tells a thousand words, because it reveals that there was a meeting at which Papadopoulos clearly had a place at the table and explained this possibility of setting up a meeting between Trump and Putin, and that reports clearly that Trump did not dismiss the idea. He listened through the idea and didn't say this meeting is at an end. Any talk about connections with Russian, of course, are off the table. No one said that. Now Sessions apparently reports that he didn't want this thing to happen. But what's clear with Sessions is he's a not a credible source, because it reveals once again his essentially inability to tell the truth over the course of time, where he has constantly said he had no connections with any Russian officials, and at no time did he know of anybody who had connections. And clearly he's at a meeting now with Papadopoulos, who clearly is admitting he's had plenty of connections and that he could set this meeting up. So I think the veneer, the credibility of the Trump people right at this point in terms of connections with Russia is clearly collapsed. And hence, the investigation has many leads to follow now. And so it's a matter of time as to how this thing's going to play out, and that Trump himself is clearly a target of this investigation.
How do you assess, by the way, how the White House has handled this? And I understand there's really two camps now going on. One is sort of the Ty Cobb, Jay Sekulow camp, which are the lawyers, saying respond cautiously. We're going to cooperate with the investigation. On the other hand, on the outside, you have people like Steve Bannon, for example, amongst many, who said we have to attack the special prosecutor, the independent counsel. How do you assess those two tacks, and what does that say about where the Trump and the White House is?
In both camps, there's a calculation about the politics of this. If we assume for the moment that Trump is in deep trouble, particularly with obstruction of justice charges, his lawyers have to be saying the best we can hope for here is that the Mueller campaign, the Mueller investigation gets derailed in some fashion or other, or if it actually reaches us, we essentially can say we cooperated as much as possible, and you'll be in a better position there politically than you would if you fight this, tooth and nail. Where the Bannon folks are saying is fight a tooth and nail, the politics, the Republicans in the Senate and in the House, they will not impeach. They'll not pursue that because of their own political needs. Whereas I think the Cobbs of this world saying, well, it could go the other way. It could very much go the other way. And your best bet is to cooperate at this point in time.
How do you compare this, say, for instance, to the Whitewater and the investigation special counsel Ken Starr against Clinton in terms of the White House response? Because the White House did trash Ken Starr. A lot of folks said lots of bad things. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Starr's investigation seems to sort of not only go on forever, but there were instances where they had made conclusions about certain aspects of it, including, for instance, Vince Foster. He concluded early on that he'd committed suicide, but that wasn't known until much later on. How do you compare the two scandals in that respect?
In one respect, clearly both investigations had wide latitude to investigate really wherever they thought reason would take them. On the other hand, I think the gravity of this case, the gravity of this situation with Russian interference in our elections, is much heavier than was the case under the Ken Starr and the Whitewater investigation. And I think that that ultimately, if in fact Mueller does reveal, if more indictments come forward, the Republicans in the Congress are going to have they're going to be put on the defensive much more, I think, than was the case under the Whitewater investigation.
Hmm. Although I reminded actually this morning, somebody mentioned the fact that during Watergate. On the impeachment committee, because they never got to a full vote, there were only something like seven Republicans actually voted for the articles of impeachment. That doesn't serve well for this idea.
Yes.
I mean, because a lot of it had already been laid out, and it actually took a tape in order to make it happen. I mean, it sounds like there's going to be real reluctance. And obviously impeachment went forward in a Congress that was actually dominated by the opposite party.
That is all true. The question, though, remains if in effect that the collusion case, I mean, this really does ride on how much evidence ultimately comes down with the collusion case. If the collusion case becomes evident, becomes overwhelmingly, manifestly evident, then the Republicans have another thing to think about, because clearly the polls are showing that Mueller has good support among the public, that he's truthful, he's pursuing the proper investigation, and the erosion of the support for Trump, it continues. I mean, down in low 30s now, mm-hmm. and the evidence of his lying. I mean, clearly Trump has lied his way to this point, and the evidence may come out further that he's further lying manifestly.
It seems to me, by the way, there are two dimensions. One is obviously the case for collusion, which may or may not be illegal, right?
Correct. That's
and
correct.
Then you have the potential for obstruction of justice in terms of firing Comey. As I understand, as a matter of fact, the Mueller is now looking at talking to Jared Kushner, who apparently was involved in some fashion with the firing of Comey. Of those two, which do you think is more significant politically? Is it obstruction of justice, or is it collusion, or could Republicans live with collusion but not obstruction, or vice versa?
Yeah, yeah. I think the collusion charge politically is the more important, the more long lasting, because if you can show collusion, then for the Republicans, they have to face the question of whether they're willing to live with a president who has, in effect, coordinated efforts with a foreign power, that has been, particularly from the Republican point of view, over the course of decades, has been our most important enemy in international affairs, and how they can carry that weight forward. The obstruction of justice, however, carries the greater danger to Trump himself, I think, in terms of being indicted. I mean, after all, the obstruction of justice case is a criminal offense, most clearly, whereas the collusion case is less. I mean, there's less opportunity there for identifying some laws that have been broken, although there are going to be there some of those as well.
What about this idea that he may decide, Donald Trump, to pardon some people, and which he certainly clearly can do? Obviously, it does not affect any kind of state actions, against, say, somebody like Manafort. But that he could just simply, one by one, sort of, okay, I'm going to pardon this person, I'm going to pardon this person, because he was such a good guy and that kind of thing. Obviously, he can do that. Are there repercussions for doing that? I know Lindsey Graham, for instance, senator, said that holy hell would break out if he fired Mueller, for example. Is there a political price to pay? I mean, is there enough there to say we've had enough?
One scenario is that he could get away with that because he clearly paid no price for his pardon of the sheriff from Arizona.
Right.
Trump clearly has indicated either a blindness or an uncaring thought about the repercussions for the Republican Party going forward. So that scenario would say he could, particularly if it's piece by piece, if it's Manafort, Carter Page, or Papadopoulos, or even him, right?
He could
pardon
that,
him,
sure,
as well. And there's a strategy behind that, because if all these folks believe, and clearly Manafort, I think his lawyer really basically called on Trump to pardon Manafort, in effect, they're playing that card. And if, as long as they keep quiet, then Trump can come forward with these pardons, and the Republicans could stay mute. I mean, it's one thing to give pardons, another thing to fire Mueller. I mean, I think what Graham was saying, you got to let this investigation go, and perhaps we can cover you with these pardons. On the other hand, do the pardons really further erode the Republican brand going forward? I mean, I think that's what these Republican leaders have to be assessing.
Do you think that if he were to issue a pardon for some of these folks, that that's may, from a political standpoint, be an admission of guilt?
Most certainly. I mean, I think that at this point, what's clear and what's becoming increasingly clear is that these connections, that these folks were, I mean, that they were part of the campaign, and it was a small campaign, and people knew what was going on, including Donald Trump. So there's going to be a political cost to be paid there.
So it seems as if Jared Kushner, people are bad-mouthing him, to say the least, out of the White House. I mean, we had Sam Nunberg, he was advisor to Trump, calling him the worst political advisor in the White House in modern history. We hear now that some reports that Trump has blamed Kushner for the decision, for instance, to fire Comey, for example. And apparently Trump has complained about Kushner to in conversations with Steve Bannon and Roger Stone, who's another political operative. I mean, it sounds like the knives are out and he could be the next to go. And then on the other hand, if you're Jared Kushner, maybe it's time to get out, although he's obviously married into the family, but maybe turn state's evidence or something. I mean, I don't know.
This is one of those mysteries that that we may, in the next few weeks, we may find out, because Kushner is indeed apparently cooperating with the investigation, Mueller's investigation. He's talking. He's revealed papers. It could be very well the case that he wants to cover his own back at this point, and may turn state's evidence. On the other hand, again, if he stays mute, relatively speaking, and even if he were to be indicted for some of these affairs, would Trump pull out the pardon for his son-in-law? I mean, this is very sticky, because it's a family relationship here that's also at risk. But again, Trump does at times often seems that those things don't matter either for him.
By the way, one name that's gotten lost is in this scandal has been Sean Spicer. He's a White House spokesman, but apparently he was notorious for copious notes. So there's not only whatever he saw, but then there's a whole set of notes. How significant might he be in this? And the fact that we haven't heard anything about him yet.
The question becomes, how much was he a part of the inner circle? One would assume that, given that he was the White House spokesperson, and that he would have to be involved in many of these meetings. And I think that part of it will involve whether or not his notes and his reporting, his information corroborates other pieces of information coming forward, perhaps with Kushner as well. So he at the end of the day, he could be playing a very important role, though I guess I don't think he's been interviewed recently on this.
Right.
So, but perhaps if we see that he's re-interviewed, and now that all these other things have been revealed, could Spicer say more and contribute more to this case? I think that's one thing we should watch for as well.
So looking at the politics of this thing, where do you see the Democrats in all of this? They seem to be sort of standing back, waiting all this, watching all this happen while they kind of denounce various dimensions of this.
Yeah. You don't interfere with a train that's wrecking, right? Going smashing into walls of various sorts. So I think that... At the end of the day, the Democrats benefit clearly from this kind of scenario, and this is this president is his credibility is collapsed. It cannot be regained, even if he survives the next year. The Republicans are going to be fighting against this image of corruption, this image of collusion with the Russians and interference with the elections. But on the other hand, I think I'm persuaded as well that the Democrats can't rely simply on that to win a wave election in 2018. Policy agenda has to be forthcoming, and I think that that is still unclear. I mean, so I don't think in any sense the Republicans can simply sit back and say we can easily win this next round of elections. They've got to get a policy agenda moving forward as well and really clarify that for the electorate.
So what do you make of two things? One is we have this story coming out about Donna Brazile talking about the Clinton folks taking over the DNC. Obviously, the Bernie Sanders people not happy about that one. Neither was she, for that matter. And at the same time, you get this pile on from the White House over the scandal about and allegations about this dossier on Trump, and the fact that the Clinton campaign, or the DNC anyway, took over funding for this opposition research. There seems to be that sort of thing sort of coming at the Democrats.
The Democrats as well. Let me take the dossier issue first. I think it's actually irrelevant as to who was involved in the funding of the dossier. I mean, if you go back, it was a Republican operative, right? And then the Democrats get in and say this is pursuing opposition research, and a company gets hired, this fusion company gets hired, and they hire an investigator to do it. So the origins, there's no indication that there was manipulation of the actual findings in the dossier. So the question really is, whoever funded it, does the dossier provide credible evidence as to what was going on with the Trump campaign? I mean, that's really clear. And it's pretty clear as well now that congressional committees, and again, even Republican-controlled congressional committees, are finding this dossier credible. And the Mueller investigation clearly has found part of this dossier credible as well. So I don't think that that will play any significant role for the Democrats in the election. What was the other issue?
And Donna Brazile.
Now, this one is fascinating because one must remember that Donna Brazile was a very important player and trusted player within the Clinton campaign itself. I mean, this was a loyalist. So when this revelation came out, I was taken aback in that sense that here's Donna Brazile, who, you know, that the Sanders people have long disliked because of her complete loyalty to the Clintons. And what this shows, I think, is that the problem in the Democratic Party as well here now is it shows that it was essentially controlled by the Clinton campaign, in a sense, bought and sold. And I think much repair has to be done. I mean, I think that this could generate a division within the Democratic Party that they can that's a great risk to them for winning the 18 election and the 20 election. So much work has to be done, I think, to say we're going to put in rules that this will never happen again. I think some of the Sanders people, I think his campaign manager, in fact, has recently said, you know, that this obviously he complained about this, but that there are now attempts to make sure that the rules governing the Democratic Party will ensure this kind of thing does not happen in the future. If that can be ensured, and if he can persuade the Sanders rank and file, the voters out there, that that's the case, then the Democrats can get beyond this. But work has to be done to do that, I think.
Because one of the questions I have in terms of Democratic politics is how much alienation this just simply reinforces by the Sanders voters who, I mean, it's all well and good to talk about, well, now we got to set a whole new set of rules, but they're still disaffected and very well could, for that matter, affect particularly the Virginia governor's race. There seems to be some disaffection there.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the immediate consequence of this could hurt
Northam's
Northam's campaign. I think that's an excellent point. But it can have other. I mean, again, down the road to peace, the 18 election is just on the horizon, and disaffection could occur there as well.
Do you think, or do you see the Democratic Party trying to figure out who it is, or are the two groups, the sort of establishment and the Sanders wing, are they that far apart in terms of policy?
My sense at this point is the answer is that they are not so far apart, and because I think that part of it is that the energy from the Sanders camp, that's the energy that I think is driving the party at this point in time. And so if we can call it the establishment folks represented by, say, Hillary Clinton, they at this point have to be reading this as, if they want to get back in power, just to make the Democrats regain the House, they're going to have to tap into that energy. And if they don't pay attention to that in terms of policy matters, the disaffection will prevent them from regaining power in the 18 or even the 20 election. So my anticipation would be that once we see the policy agenda emerge, the tilt will be more towards a more progressive character to it, yeah.
I mean, because we have a number of potential presidential candidates who already come out in favor, for instance, single payer.
Yes, right.
I think that's really interesting.
Now, that would be one of the most – I mean, if, in fact, that becomes sort of one of the banner agenda pieces, then that tells us a lot about the political dynamics operating in the Democratic Party.
We've been speaking with Salisbury University political science professor Michael Laughlin about not only the scandal but also where the Democrats are. Appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
My pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.